I'm Dick Gordon. Coming up, the story of two friends separated by the violence that has recently become part of life for most Kenyans. Moses Odhiambo is from the Luo tribe. Tony Gakuo is Kikuyu. They'll sit down together in a studio in Nairobi to talk about what's changed. Ever since they met each other in high school almost 15 years ago, they say their own tribal histories never mattered. But now they worry about what they see and hear on the street, not just from the thugs, but from the children.
You would see a kid say to another kid he's been playing with, "I'm going to kill you, you're Luo," or something like that. They don't really mean it, but they don't know exactly what they're saying. And it shocks us.
Tony Gakuo and Moses Odhiambo have both been kind of holed up at home. They haven't seen each other in months, but they'll join me to talk about how the violence is affecting their country and their friendship. That conversation is coming up right after the news. It was almost 2 months ago when violence broke out in Kenya. It came amid accusations that the president had rigged elections. Neighbors turned on neighbors as the dispute brought old tribal and class tensions to the surface. As many as 1,000 people have been killed. Those politicians and others from outside have been trying to mediate a way forward, but the way back to stability may well rest with the people themselves. I'll talk with two of them, two young men living in the Kenyan capital of Nairobi. They're friends from high school, friends who fear that their own different tribal histories will keep tearing at the country and could even affect their friendship. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
The Story is produced by North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. It's co-produced and distributed by American Public Media.
Back in early January, when armed gangs were still roaming the slums of Nairobi, I talked with one young man. Tony Gakuo is a musician with a wide circle of friends. But like so many other people in Kenya, he was pretty well pinned down in his house waiting for a lull in the fighting. And he was frustrated.
Sometimes when I watch the news, I just feel like I wish I could do something more. I wish I could just get out of my neighborhood, go buy something, some food, some water, and just take it to the places where there's violence. And honestly, sometimes I just feel like, you know, I want to go join with the people who are fighting and, you know, and just protect the ones who are the kids who, you know, are vulnerable and no one to protect them. Like last night, I was imagining if anything would happen to my younger brother, I really don't know, and I don't think I would control myself. And that's why I can't judge the people who are fighting. It's really sad. It's really sad. Unless there's an end to this, I think it's going to get worse.
Tony, I'd like to stay in touch with you as we watch what happens in Kenya. Can we check back in with you at some point in the future?
That would be fine. That would be fine.
People of all tribes in Kenya have faced the same questions that Tony's wondering about, if their own ethnic or family loyalties would ever be tested by the violence. Not just Kikuyus like Tony, but Kalenji, Luyas, and Luos as well. We did stay in touch with Tony. And today, he and one of his best friends, Moses Odhiambo, are joining us from the BBC studios in Nairobi. Tony, as I mentioned, is Kikuyu. Moses is Luo. They hadn't seen each other in months. It was good just to listen in as they greeted each other.
Yeah, we've not seen each other for long, man.
Tony and Moses explained to me that they've known each other for years and that their different tribal backgrounds had never mattered to either one of them. They say it still doesn't matter today, at least not between the two of them. But out in the city, Tony says, they both have to be careful to think about where they can go and where they can't go.
There are certain places I haven't traveled to since December. And yeah, that's one of the reasons why I've not been able to meet with Moses. Nothing major has happened in Nairobi, but you just be careful and not to get caught up.
Give me an example of a place that you can't go or wouldn't go.
I need to get a new ID, and I can't go to the police station, to the district office at Kibera.
That's the big slum there.
That's a slum in Nairobi. So I have to wait until all this chaos has settled down, or even maybe look for a different place to go get my ID.
And why wouldn't you go to Kibera? Why wouldn't you go to the police station that's there?
Oh, my goodness. That would be like shooting myself in the head.
Explain that for me. I don't understand it.
The unfortunate thing for Kikuyus, we are easily identified by the way we look. We're brown. So it's very easy to be identified. So if I were to go to Kibera, for instance, if anything would happen, I would definitely be a target because they can easily identify me.
Moses, just when you were coming to the studio today or in your own travels around Nairobi, what do you see now that shows you things are still a little bit unsettled?
the thing like I notice the most is people hate being confined. Most of us were used to moving around. Like our generation, like me and Tony's, we'd never experienced something like this, like a coup or anything, you know. Mm. So to us, we hadn't even thought of something like this. We used to see it with our neighbors, you know. And in an instant, you can't move. You can't go to the supermarket. You can't do anything. So you just stay put. The first reaction is just shock because you don't know how to react to that, you know. Mm. But right now, you get the feeling that people are glad that at least the news about some of the skirmishes have gone down. But people are worried about what's happening on the political scene. So a lot of people are becoming skeptical. Like banks now are not giving loans anymore.
Huh.
So that's how bad it started becoming. Yeah.
And difficult to do business, I understand.
Definitely.
Yeah, I've been broke since December, man. The entertainment industry is really, really affected.
Yeah, you're both music producers. It must be really hard for both of you.
Yeah.
We just have too much time to ourselves doing absolutely nothing.
So what do you do, Tony? Watch TV? What do you do?
I just play music the whole day. Sleep, wake up again, play music the whole day. But no one is coming to the studio. I'm not recording anyone, not working on any project so far.
We'll hear some of the music they both love later in the show. Tony Gakuo and Moses Odhiambo say it was music that brought them together years ago.
Oh, my goodness.
We were in the same school in high school.
We were in high school together.
Yeah. So that's like 1994.
94.
Yeah.
And you have known each other since then. So you've been friends for 14 years, right?
Yep.
Yeah, we have been like brothers since then. Yeah.
Yeah.
And even early on, when you met each other and you started to hang out together, were you aware at that time, oh, he's Kikuyu, he's Luo, does this matter, does this not matter, does it even...
It never came up.
No.
It never came up. What concerned us then was what we loved doing, you know. He loved music, I loved music, and that's the only thing we'd probably talk about, you know, and soccer.
Would you ever tease each other? Would one of you say to the other, oh, you're such a Kikuyu, or you're such a Luo, that sort of thing?
Yeah. That would happen, and I wouldn't take it personally.
That's the thing that has been happening with this generation. Actually, most Kenyans, people use ethnicity for humor. And the only people who are serious about ethnicity were probably the politicians. And the rest of the country didn't even take them seriously anyway.
Can you explain to me, Tony, how you use it for humor? Like, just give me an example of the kind of banter that would go on between you two.
Luos have... more than one phone.
More than one mobile phone, okay.
When the mobile phones... So somebody's on a mobile phone. There's this common joke. A Luo man, when you call up a Luo man on his mobile phone, the first response would be, hey, how did you know I was here? Because Kenyans were used to landlines. So I don't even get that. Yeah, but there's so many like that. And then Kikuyus...
The joke behind it was Kikuyus were either the thugs. You know, most of the thugs being caught.
Yeah, I love money.
Most of the guys on death row, most of the most wanted criminals are Kikuyu. So any joke about a guy loving cash, like if like Tony would demand his change in a bus, I'd go like, you're such a Kikuyu. Do you have to get, you know, something like that.
When the bill comes up, you expect a Kikuyu man to check how much it is. You expect a Luo man to show everybody how many notes he has. Yeah. I mean, that's the type it was. And it was really funny. It was cool.
But it never went past that.
Yeah, I was going to say, it sounds like an affectionate kind of humor, yeah?
Yeah, exactly. It is.
That's how it's always been.
And that's why it was so shocking for both Moses Odhiambo and Tony Gakuo to see violence in Kenya break out along those tribal lines. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. Time now for a short step back to see this as part of an African narrative that began 45 years ago. Ever since Kenya's first president heralded the independence of the nation back in 1963, Kenya's been regarded as a place where the tribes did get along, although it was still something that Jomo Kenyatta was determined to underline.
We have known racial hatred in this land. Let it be forgotten. We have experienced the setting of one tribe against another. Let us not remember it now.
I asked Tony Gakuo and Moses Odhiambo if they had any memory themselves of the kind of differences that once divided Kenyans. They said no, those distinctions were before their time.
Our parents, back then, you went to school in your rural area. Yeah. So your classmates were your tribe mates. Mm. That's how it was back in the day. So it's not like us when we immediately went to kindergarten, you were mixed from the get-go. So yeah. To us, I'm 27 now. And all my life, I've had these political tones, you know, these tribal tones. Mm. But they were never serious. In fact, whenever they came up, they were shot down, you know.
Yeah.
But it happened so fast, you almost get this feeling that either someone planned this.
Yeah.
Or, you know.
Don't really know what happened.
If you look at it in perspective, the guys who are doing the killing are age mates.
Yeah.
It's not the old guys. It's our age mates who are doing this. So, honestly, right now, Dick, if right now I heard Tony was in trouble, I'd take a bullet for him. That's just how it is, you know.
I wouldn't.
But you get the idea. We are young guys, and it's hard to believe that another young guy can just pick up. They probably went to the same school, and you almost get the feeling that someone must be either feeding these guys with some information or getting paid to do something, you know.
I don't know. Yeah, it's hard to understand how it happened. I really don't know. People say it's tribal. We all think it's tribal, political, but I think there must be something else to it, because there's no way you can pick up a machete, hack somebody to death, and then do that for like 3 days in a row. There must be something else driving you. I don't know what that was, but we have to look at it. We have to, once we are calm, we have to sit down and look at it as Kenyans. Something really happened, and we have to know what happened.
A majority of this population is young people. Mm. Most of them are idle.
Your frustration.
They are frustrated, and young guys look for something to believe in, something to occupy them. Whether it's spiritual, whether it doesn't really matter, but young guys have all this energy, and if they don't have a way of channeling it out, if someone else steps in and does something different and channels it to something negative, that's exactly what will happen. So that's another flip side that I saw, because most of us young guys are jobless, you know. So someone can take advantage of that, you know, and step in, you know, idle minds, you know.
The whole situation has left Moses Odhiambo and Tony Gakuo wondering if they have a role in helping stem the violence. They're musicians and producers. One of Tony's projects is this song, Wakenya Pamoja. I'll talk more with both of them about music and the future of their country in just a moment. I'm Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. There are early reports from Kenya today that the politicians there are close to a power-sharing deal, precisely the kind of arrangement that might bring an end to the fighting there. No one would welcome that news more than my two guests today. Moses Odhiambo is Luo. His friend Tony Gakuo is Kikuyu. They are old friends, both musicians in Nairobi. The other thing they share is that the recent tribal violence in Kenya turned both of their lives and their families upside down.
The funny thing is, Tony lives like probably 15 minutes away from where I live. And I was holed up in the house for...
Maybe it was 7 days.
Yeah, 7 days going to 2 weeks, you know. No one would dare come out. And the farthest you'd go is go get shopping and come back, you know.
Shop.
And if it was checking up on someone, you either call someone or you text someone. That's how bad it was. You couldn't visit someone who was 15 minutes away.
For me, for 7 days, I couldn't talk to anyone because I didn't have airtime on my phone. I couldn't leave because... Of course, yeah, you can't leave a house. The fourth day, we ran out of food. So we're just in the house with my brother. And there's nothing much you can do. And then the week after, transport was still down. Communication was also a problem. Yeah, so that's how it was.
What effect did this violence have on family? How close did it reach to you, Tony?
I had some relatives in the Rift Valley. The best I know is they were relocated, but I do not know where they are. I've not been able to get in touch with them. And I don't know what is going on. So,
is it your belief that they've probably lost their homes in the Rift Valley?
Of course, yeah, they have. Yeah, unfortunately, most Kikuyus have lost their property in the Rift Valley. And most of them moved out. But that has nothing to do with the Luos and the Kikuyus. That's a different...
It's only connected to the sort of broader thing. Violence. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Was anyone in your family injured, Tony?
No, not that I know of.
Moses, what about your family? How close did the violence come to you?
You know, most people think that it was only Luos against Kikuyus, but even Luos looted other Luos property, you know. People never look at that side because my mom lives alone and it's a target for an idle guy, you know. So she was pretty scared. She had a few incidences near her house, but she wasn't really hurt. My sister, she called me in the morning, 2nd January, and she told me that the guys who were going door to door, and she had to run away like at 5 in the morning. Mm-hmm. And that's just here in Nairobi, and she had to take her kids. The funny thing is she passed these guys. She had to talk Kikuyu to her kids so that these guys would leave her, you know. Later on, it calmed down, and then her husband stayed behind. A few days later, some guys came back, and the good thing is the landlord protected him, and the landlord is Kikuyu. So on that night, the landlord told him, come sleep in my house. If these guys come, I won't let them come in. So the first night they came, they were telling him, we know there's a Luo who lives in here in your compound, so... He said, no, these guys left when all these things started. So they said they'll come back the next day to loot his house.
Moses, let me just interrupt you if I can. I want to make sure that I'm understanding this. Your sister is Luo, and she was being threatened by Kikuyu gangs, but her landlord is a Kikuyu, and he offered her shelter. He offered her protection.
Yeah, and the next day, the landlord gave my brother-in-law money to get out of there, and he took most of their household stuff and put it in his store. So that night, those guys came back, broke into the house, and didn't find anything. So at least there's some good that's out of it, because the landlord protected them, and he keeps checking up on them once in a while. So,
but it'll probably be hard for your sister to go back, yeah.
Yeah, she can't go back, yeah.
And if she was with us in the studio, and we were talking to her about what's changed, would she be carrying around with her anger about Kikuyus, or just anger about what's going on in Kenya? What would she say?
The last time I spoke to her, her anger is not targeted at Kikuyus. It's probably at the politicians, because these guys had a chance, you know. Yeah. They had a very good chance of calming this thing down, but they didn't.
Because the politicians were using ethnicity way before the elections to put each other community down for competition. They used it, but we didn't take it seriously as Kenyans because we didn't think it would get to this point. And when the violence broke out, they should have been the first ones to calm everybody down because they're the ones who are using ethnicity for competition. And they didn't. And most of them would have had a big influence if they appeared in front of the public, maybe together on different occasions, and just telling people, calm down. It's not a tribal thing. It's a political thing. It needs a political solution. That they did not do. I think most Kenyans are really mad at them, totally disappointed.
Because even if you look at how much they spent during the campaign, they spent millions going around the country.
Yeah.
And it's not like they didn't have the capacity to do the same at this time, you know.
When the country needs
them. When the country really needed them, what's stopping you from taking that overland track and going around the country and telling people to stop? But they just stayed put and kept quiet.
Tony, the very first time we spoke, it was early January. The violence was still in Nairobi. There was smoke coming from the homes in Kibera, and we talked at that time. And I said, you know, what is it like for you? And you said, you know, I don't want to be a part of this. This is not the Kenya that I know. And I said, yeah, but could you be drawn in? And the one thing you said to me at that time, Tony, was, if my younger brother was attacked, I don't know what I'd do. I don't know if that's the moment when I would pick up a weapon and join the fighting. And I guess what I need to try and hear from the two of you is, did you ever question yourselves? Did you ever think to yourself, oh, man, could I be drawn into this as well?
I did, and... That's why I did not blame anyone who picked up a machete and attacked the other, because if I was in a situation where I would see my brother or somebody close to me, or even this guy, Moses, being hugged to death, there's no way I'd control myself.
Oh, Personally, I had an experience a while ago. I was taking a bus home, and the bus had mostly Kikuyus. Actually, it only had Kikuyus. And they were talking in Kikuyu, and they're talking to each other. They realized I wasn't contributing to the conversation. Mm-hmm. And one of the guys asked me, so are you Kikuyu? We could be talking to a Luo here, and we don't know. At that moment, I had to say I wasn't a Luo. And luckily, my complexion helped me out there because my complexion is slightly different. And it was a split second, and I knew it could be bad. It only takes one stupid guy to say something like, let's finish this guy off. Yeah. And it's over, you know. And at that moment, it was the first time that it came to my attention that actually you could get drawn into this without even wanting it, you know. Mm. I got home safe, but yeah, it was really scary.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. Moses Odhiambo and Tony Gakua are still puzzling over where they fit in all of this, if they have to sit at home as frustrated spectators, or if they can make a contribution that will help Kenya move back to more peaceful times. They are musicians. One project Tony was involved with was a recent song called Wakenya Pamoja. It means Kenyans together. And it was recorded by a group of musicians who represent nearly every major tribe in Kenya.
Iko hivi, kuimba mimi siwezi, lakini the truth of the matter is, fahali wawili wakipigana, nyasi ndio umia. Na ndio unaona tunaendelea kukanyagwa kanyagwa.
It was an abrupt thing, it wasn't planned. In fact, the night before, there was chaos within the studios that we did that song itself. At that night, a couple of musicians got together and they decided to march to respective headquarters of all these political parties and urge these leaders to do something about peace and encouraging their supporters to be peaceful. And in the process of just walking, guys just came up with a hook. Wakenya pamoja tujenge. The following day, like over 50 artists came together and recorded the whole thing. And the video was also done the same day.
So you did all that video shooting in just one day?
Yeah, everything, the shooting, the song itself, the composing, the editing, everything was done in one day. We just sent messages to every musician who was interested, and the turnout was incredible. And on that same day, we launched the Pamoja Trust. We got down to committees and we planned everything in that one day, so it was really incredible. We had over 50 people in the compound doing various types of music, different genres, targeting different people, different audiences, from very different backgrounds. Others were not from Nairobi, so it was an incredible, incredible turnout. And it just shows the kind of spirit that Kenyans have.
Can this make a difference, do you think, Moses? The positive things that people of your age are doing, can it help?
I think there's a balance that has to be struck. On one hand, we can only do what we're able to do within our powers. If the video gets played once every 6 hours, yeah, and in those 6 hours, all you're seeing are pictures of people being killed, it almost reduces the effect the song or the intention of the song had, you know. As young guys, we do what we can and expect the next person to pick it up from where we've left off and push it further. Just artists just get together and, you know, let's just do this, you know. Mm. But you wouldn't see any business investor telling you, okay, I'll pump in some money, go around the country. No one's doing that, you know. Everyone's still on their own and, you know, I'm thinking that probably will make it take longer to have an effect. But we're still trying. It's not that we've given up. We're still trying.
We're not about.
Yeah.
You guys are sitting together in that radio studio in Nairobi, and it's the first time you've been together for about 6 months, you were telling me earlier. I mean, it must be good to see a friend that you haven't seen for that long, but...
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, right. Definitely. Definitely. It does feel good.
I'm tempted to put these things down and just get it. I know what's been going on with each other, man.
Yeah, I know. You have to bear with me. Just stay with the microphones for a bit because we need to understand your country through you. I wonder if you, either one of you, had any hesitation at all about coming to the studio today. Maybe not on a personal level, but somebody saying to you, you're not going to go and hang out with that Luo guy. You're not going to hang out with that Kikuyu guy again, are you?
I'd be shocked if something like that happened.
But that is happening. Some friendships are being upset, right?
Maybe just for the time being.
What do you think, Moses?
I was excited, you know, because I've never been put in a situation where I had to express my own opinion at this level. And secondly, I was going to meet Tony, you know. So
plus,
I knew I might not be known that much, but I can definitely guarantee you there are people like me who'd share my same sentiments. And despite what we've gone through, I think we still see eye to eye with Tony, you know. And it's a chance to just say what we have, whether the guys up there don't listen or, you know. But we definitely have a say in this, you know.
Even the politicians themselves, we were seeing this on TV. They would appear on telly, they're clashing, and then in the evening they're hanging out in the bars and they're discussing how one had a kick over the other and the other gained mileage over the other. I mean, it's not a big deal. So,
I know, but it's not a game. You know what I mean? It's not like a football game where you have players who fight for an hour in on the match and then they go off for a drink after that. This is serious stuff.
And that's why the blame is on them. And that's why the blame is on them, because they were irresponsible. They did not see this.
You're listening to The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. Tribal and ethnic conflict is not new to Africa. It's what tore apart people in Rwanda. And it's largely a part of the conflict in places like Sudan and Somalia and Congo. Both Tony and Moses worry that soon their country, Kenya, will bear the stigma of one more nation where citizens seem unable to resolve whatever it is that divides them.
We always attach stigma to certain people. When the Rwandese went through what they went through, 10 years later you meet a Rwandese and subconsciously you'll attach a certain stigma to them. You'll feel sorry for them, you know. Like also with AIDS victims, you know. The same thing is happening to Kenyans. People can't seem to detach the images they saw in the news with the rest of the Kenyans. Like, us guys work every day, you know. But people start seeing us differently. It's not the way they used to see Kenyans before. And we hear it from Kenyans who are abroad, students who are there. They started getting it while they're already there, you know. People look at them slightly different, you know.
Have you seen this or heard this in any personal terms, Moses, where someone has said to you, oh, I don't know if I want to do business with you, the Kenyan music producer?
There's some people who you would relate with before, and like they'd give you straight up answers. Let's say you had a business deal with someone, and this person normally got back to you like within a day or two, you know. And this time around, you contact the person, and he's not so keen on doing business with you or relating with you at that level you used to. You could feel that they're holding back, you know, something like that. So it's definitely happened.
There's so much disappointment in the Western media. Kenya has been branded as a war-torn country. Do not go there. I mean, these guys have gone crazy. They're slashing each other. I was sometimes very, very disturbed to see on TV some journalist who, and you see this is a white man, particularly just running after people who are going to commit acts of violence. And he would stick there just to take shots, some really nasty shots, some brutal shots of somebody being hacked to death. And that's all he's interested in. And once he's gotten that, he's satisfied. And the next thing you hear, my mom is in the UK and my brother's in the States and two of them are also in the UK. They would immediately call up like, we've seen these nasty images on telly. what is going on? And try and calm them down, try to tell them, hey, by the way, the whole country is kind of calm. It's only a few places. It does not mean the whole country is like that. And unfortunately, this has been taken to the whole world, and I don't know how this is going to be repaired. And it's been there, it's been consistent. The first thing we get from the Western world is judgment, and it's always negative.
This is one of the songs featuring the creativity of Moses Odhiambo. Both Moses and Tony Gakuo told me that they've been frustrated by the fact that they can't work, that it's hard to get to the studio when the city's so on edge. I'll ask them what it'll all mean to their friendship in just a moment. I'm Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story. The truth, the other half just meant to prove a point to you. I don't do this because I really want to, because you've been doing this from the day I met you. Now, remember when you said you love me endlessly, ain't no one like me in this world, just me. Figured you say the same thing to Ian, so I got my game up, but you got your girlfriend. So if you don't change, I'll just keep lying to you, straight up in your face, calling you my boo. As they say, the people who can play this game are only two, yeah, just me and Dean. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. I'm talking with Tony Gakuo and Moses Odhiambo. They are two close friends in Nairobi, Kenya, both musicians, each from a different tribe. They've been watching in horror over the past 2 months as hundreds of thousands of people have been chased from their homes, people in their own families as well, as a result of political and tribal tension. Now, they were telling me earlier that whatever ancestral differences they have inherited, it's never mattered to either one of them. That Tony is Kikuyu and Moses is Luo was little more than fodder for jokes. I wanted to know, though, if they worry that those tribal differences could one day in the future affect that friendship.
Absolutely not. Can never do.
But in a way, it's made us wiser, because when you've seen such a thing happen, the younger kids coming after us, it's not like we're going to stay young forever. And how we relate now really matters to these kids growing up right now, the next guys coming after us. So all they can do is look up. What they see up there is what they'll do.
Yeah, because there's certain things that we now have to do that we probably wouldn't have done before. Okay. A couple of my friends, the kids who maybe like 9, 10 years old, you would see a kid say to another kid he's been playing with, I'm going to kill you, you're Luo, or something like that. They don't really mean it, but they don't know exactly what they're saying. And it shocks us. There are certain things that we have to do in this generation, to these kids especially, to the younger generation, because unless it happens, it's only going to be worse.
I don't actually know what to think myself, because when I read the stories about the Kikuyu families that have been forced from their land in the Rift Valley and told that they'll never be welcomed back again, and when I read the stories about the Luo family that are displaced from their neighborhoods in Nairobi, part of me is left to conclude that things will never be the same again. Things are not going to go back to the way they were 6 months ago. Can you guys, can the two of you work with that? Can you live with that?
For the people who are affected, I don't know how we can help them, you know. Because I know guys who saw their daughters being raped and their sons being killed, and he'll be bitter for the rest of his life. There's nothing much you can do to that guy. You can't really tell him it's going to be okay. It's not okay. But we should be thinking about those years that are coming. Because if we don't think about those now, we'll have another election and the same thing will happen again.
But we're still on the edge, because between December 27th and now, nothing really has happened apart from people coming down. We still need to know the truth about the election. And anyone who broke the law has to come to book.
Let me, if I can, just wrap up by asking you guys. I've invited you into a studio to talk about your friendship and how you see, you know, what's happened to your families and whether or not, you know, the fact that you come from different tribes will make any difference. This coming together to do it in this kind of conversation, is it awkward for you? I mean, you say you were raised not even thinking or paying attention to ethnicity in Kenya, and here I am asking you all these questions about it. Is that kind of weird?
No, it's not. It's not weird. Okay, because of what had happened. Before December 27th, we wouldn't have done this.
Yeah. And we'd hope if we were doing this, it was about music. If it was about music, we were hoping. So, but now we're here because of...
But of course, because of what has happened, yeah, we have to do this.
Well, you guys have been very honest with your feelings, and I appreciate it.
Thanks for the interest.
So one more question. When this interview ends and we turn the microphones off, do you guys get up and leave and go home, or do you use this opportunity to sort of catch up and say, hey, what have you been up to?
Oh, yeah, we catch up, man. We just put these things down and first start making noise and just catching up with each other. This guy's grown a bit bigger. So I will need to know what he had been doing and where he was when all this stuff was going on.
Maybe not getting enough exercise, being in the house too much.
Yeah.
All right. Well, listen, the best to both of you. Thanks for your time, and I hope we get a chance to talk again.
Okay. Thank you so much, Nick.
Thanks, Nick.
Tony Gakuo and Moses Odhiambo live in Nairobi, Kenya. Special thanks today to the people at the BBC studio in Nairobi for their help with this. And we have links to the song that we're listening to, the Wakenya Pamoja song, and more of their music. You'll find it all on our website at thestory.org. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. Now, here's one about an old building. You know how there's always one building in town that has some great history, or in some cases, great mystery. Emily Kingsley wrote in to tell me about a building that she could see from her bedroom window when she was growing up in Hewelton in northern New York State. It's a building that also caught the imagination of her dad, David Kingsley.
Well, it's the only three-story building in town, and it's the only stone building in town. So it's a pretty imposing structure. I can remember the building when I was a child with a grocery store. My mother did all her grocery shopping there and never really thought about it. I went away to college and came back and was sitting in my kitchen one day, and this three-story stone building was sitting there. And I said to my wife, I wonder what's on the second and third floor. I'd never been up there, and I probably would have been better off just letting it go at that, but I didn't.
I knew a couple of stores like that myself when I was a kid, and there were always people living upstairs. Was that your assumption, that there were just people up there?
I guess I didn't have any assumptions. You know, lived there, driven by it thousands of times, and never thought about it.
And Emily, what are your first recollections of this building?
I can remember going in, you know, just sort of white bread on the shelves and ketchup, and it would be open for a couple of years and then closed.
Just as the economy drove people to do their shopping in Ogdensburg, which is 7 miles away, it was just tougher and tougher for these small mom-and-pop grocery stores to stay in business and close the doors.
Emily, could you see this building from the window of your bedroom where you grew up?
Yeah, actually, I could see right into the second and third story windows. But I don't ever remember noticing that view until we had somebody visit us from New York City or somewhere, and he came up and told us, wow, that beautiful facade that you have down the river, oh, that increases your property value so much, you know, and I thought, oh, wow, well, that's my personal view because I can see it from my personal bedroom, you know.
It's wonderful the way people who come in from outside notice things that you end up, you know, walking by or riding by every day. Did you and your sister have any curiosity about it after it closed up? You know, what really goes on in there, that sort of thing?
it wasn't into that, you know, childhood imagination that's like, you know, magical creatures or monsters right. or something like that. It was sort of more realistic, like, you know, maybe there is a safe full of money, although I guess that's not that realistic. But
David, tell me what it was that got you interested enough to want to look inside yourself. I've been there for years and years. What was it that made you think, hey, I should look inside?
I guess I knew that there was some talk of it going up for taxes, and I cringed to think, you know, someone buying the corner lot and putting in another convenience store or gasoline station. And before somebody actually did that, and I lost the opportunity to go through and find out what the second and third floor was like, that if I was ever going to do it, I probably should make a couple phone calls and see if I could do it.
What was it like inside?
As you'd expect, where you close a deli and walk out the door, there was some shelving there. We're going through this with flashlights because obviously there's no power. So we went to the basement.
I remember seeing bags and bags of garbage and dead pigeon bodies and big piles of pigeon manure.
Pigeon manure piled how high?
I would say knee high.
Then we walked to the second floor. The building had one great room, which was half the second floor was one room.
I remember walking through and checking out the different bedrooms. One of the closets in particular still had clothes hanging in it, and which was sort of fascinating, you know, to think about packing up and moving out and thinking, you know what, I'm never going to wear that jacket. I'll just leave it here. And then thinking of someone 40 years down the road, taking it off the hanger and looking in the pockets. I just thought that was really neat.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. Both David Kingsley and his daughter Emily found their interest in this old building was piqued when they looked up the wide stairs that led to the third floor.
There's a staircase that goes directly from the street straight up to the third floor. And it's a really wide, open staircase. That's pretty unusual. You know, most times when you're going to go up the stairs to the third floor, you kind of go up to a landing, turn around, turn around, turn around. And there's sort of a sweeping railing. And I just remember going up these wide stairs. And of course, they're creaky and they're wood and they're all worn down. But as soon as you come to the top and you turn and look into this big open space, it's really, really bright.
I had heard some rumblings. Oh, yeah, there's an opera house on the third floor. And you kind of discount all that because, you know, if there's an opera house on the third floor, why wouldn't someone do something about it? And it was there. If I had any thoughts of being able to walk away from this building and let someone tear it down, they rapidly disappeared because you walked into what we now know was the opera house. 14-foot ceilings and tall windows all the way around it.
I mean, to listen to the two of you describe it, it sounds like that was the treasure in the building, to sort of stumble on this huge space.
Yeah, I think so. And you can see our house from it, which is even neater. And there are just so many little touches. There's beautiful trim, and there are signatures on the wall written in pencil. You know, such and such was here 1917, good luck winter 1902, just scrawled on the wall as if it was written there yesterday. And it really did have a real direct sense of history, sort of, more so than you find, you know, when you visit like a historical monument with a plaque that describes what happens here. Here you're seeing like actual handwriting, and it's just so real.
We found some props, and there was a rolled up stage curtain that we unrolled that had scenery painted on it.
There's another thing, and that is sort of a giant wheel. And the wheel was used to gain purchase in order to lift heavy things up onto the top floor.
You mean if you were bringing pieces of stage setting up, you could lift them up with this pulley?
Yeah, exactly. It was like a pulley. It's probably 10 feet in diameter. I'm prone to exaggeration, but I think that that's a legitimate
estimate. I was picturing something like a bicycle tire.
Oh, no, no, no. It's about maybe twice as tall as I am. I just remember the first time seeing it and thinking, wow, wouldn't it be neat if this would, you know, really work? But it's wood, so I sort of expected it to be kind of soggy and maybe creaky. But I just remember walking up to it and, you know, laying a hand on it, and just the weight of my hand caused it to turn.
Is this like a spinning wheel out of a fairy tale?
Yeah.
Turns out the house had been owned by the Pickens family. David's research shows that it wasn't really that unusual to have created this kind of space for an artistically inclined family back in the mid-1800s.
Some wealthy people in those towns realized the value of performing arts, and each village wanted to have a place where troupes could come and put on their shows.
How hard was it to find all this out?
We have a pretty good historian who chased back a lot of this stuff, and we chased some of it actually through the opera community because of John Picken's granddaughters. And the more you looked, the more you found that people would either come up with oral history of stories that their grandfather told them or actual artifacts of playbills and stuff.
Who were the granddaughters?
Bessie and Jessie, the Abbott sisters. They went on to become, one of them went on to become a legitimate opera star, and the other sister was also a good performer.
And they would have performed in this opera.
We have every reason to believe they performed there. We don't have any playbills of them performing there. But they went off in the early 1900s, so that would have put her in Hewelton in during the time the opera house was functioning.
If you allow your imagination to fill in the blanks here, David, I mean, I'm wondering if the Abbott sisters, Bessie and Jessie, were just kids who grew up in their grandfather's big opulent home and took advantage of the fact that he had this theater, and that in some way led to their careers, or it became a showcase for them because they were good singers. I don't know. What do you think?
I would not be a bit surprised at that. I'm sure that every grandfather out there, if he had granddaughters with any talent or bent that way, would certainly provide him every opportunity. And there were also not the diversions that we have today. I'm sure that people would be thrilled to go and hear local talent. So,
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. David Kingsley will tell you now that he knew early on he'd never be able to walk away from this history, this building, Picken's Hall. He decided he had to do something. Now, it turns out there was this group that had just started in Hewelton, a beautification committee, and they were musing about putting up planters, flowers. Then David arrived.
I walked into their meeting and just said, I think that you have bigger things to do here. You really need to save the old stone building. A couple ladies that were at that meeting came up with the idea, yeah, let's form an historic association. Let's get our 501c3, and then we can buy it for a dollar, and on and on.
And how long has this been going on?
About 7 years.
Emily, I wonder if you've watched this project have some kind of effect on your father.
I don't think that even my dad can deny that he loves to talk to people. And this project has sort of given him the opportunity to talk to a whole lot of people, many, many people. But it also has given him the chance to sort of talk to people about something that's pretty important and that really has some meaning. You know, instead of just shooting the breeze, it's come help me with this project, or what do you have to offer? What do you think we should do?
And do you think that this building itself has some kind of personality? You've showered a lot of dust out of your hair after working on there. I mean, have you found little notes, little bits of treasure tucked behind baseboards that weren't meant to disappear, that sort of
thing? We actually found behind one wall when we tore off some wall paneling from the grocery side, there was a sawed-off doorknob. And we got checking further, and the sawed-off doorknob went to a safe. In there wasn't the money that Emily was looking for, anything like that. But there was handwritten poems. They were very sweet poems that somebody wrote and shoved in the back corner of this safe. Little touches like that.
How long do you figure it'll be before you actually throw the switch and the lights and the music come on in that opera hall on the third floor?
Now, you have to understand that I am the optimist in my family. I would like to say 3 years. Emily did take us up, I think it was last summer, and decided we should hear what the opera house sounded like. So we've actually had some music in the opera house. One of our main supporters, who's 80 years old, he and his wife brought lawn chairs and came up and sat and listened, and oh, they just thought it was great. So.
You know, David, there are lots of small towns in upstate New York that are going through really difficult financial times. I don't know where you mark Hewelton on that list of towns that are having their share of difficulties as the economy changes. But do you think Pickens Hall can make a difference, like a real difference in Hewelton?
I feel it's going to make a tremendous difference. Since Pickens Hall started, people from Atlanta have come in and bought a two-story building. So we hope to become a destination point for people traveling through and giving them a reason to stop. And we feel we can make a difference.
We have some great pictures of Pickens Hall on our website at thestory.org, as well as links there, so you can find out more about what's going on in Hewelton. David Kingsley joined me from North Country Public Radio in Canton, New York. Emily Kingsley was in the NPR studio in Concord, New Hampshire. If you have a story to share, get in touch with me through our website. Once again, thestory.org. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
The Story is a production of North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill.
American Public Media.